Does the panel recognize these attorneys? Are they licensed? Yeah. Good morning. This is case number 53039, Shack versus Barbara Ann Hollier Trust. We have Mr. Gentile for the appellant. We have Mr. Jimerson for the respondent. Mr. Gentile, do you want to reserve any time on this?
5 minutes.
Okay. We're ready for you.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, I would also like to reserve a couple of minutes. I would like to speak last. We have appeals and prosecutors.
Fine. That'll be the order.
12 or 13 minutes and save two or three.
Excellent.
I
would expect that from both of you. We're ready for you. We've got our seatbelts on, and we're ready for both of you, and for this case, and for also for the next case. So we're all set.
Mr. Jimerson and I have discussed that, given the what appears like a tennis match here in terms of the pleadings, we're going to just abandon who goes first on what issues and go right for it.
Go for it.
Okay, thank you. If it pleases the court, this case is before you mainly because sophisticated business people on both sides of this transaction, Bill Shack, my client, was a former owner of Shack Finley Honda and a couple of other dealerships here and in California. Mrs. Lawson has been in the real estate business forever, and there's a good chance that maybe some of the justices actually know some of the people or the families here, because they've been here a long time. But the long and the short of it is that the case comes before you, and it went before the jury on the theory that there was a seller's remorse involved here. There was a sale and a lease option. Excuse me, there was a lease and an option as part of a contract. They were separate parts of a single contract. Contract called for $100,000 to be paid for the option price. Contract called for $100,000 security deposit on the lease. The dispute started almost immediately. With respect to how it's important to this case, the option was dealt with in a summary judgment pretrial. We took the position that by securing a piece of real estate with a note, that accommodated the option condition. That's important because that piece of real estate was sold. And even after the judge ruled on summary judgment that it did not accommodate the option purchase, Mr. Shack left $100,000 in the account because there was still a breach of contract action that was still alive as far as Mrs. Lawson was concerned. And so if it turned out that he had to pay her damages, the money was already there. I submit to you that when he testified at trial, that it was in no way inconsistent positions that would judicially stop him from claiming that the $100,000 was his at the end. That's a minor issue in the big picture. The biggest issue here, as I see it, is the question of damages, and that the jury award damages correctly. Were they argued correctly? And were they instructed correctly? We have a general verdict form. Both sides here agreed to all exhibits and all instructions. They were stipulated to. So there was no issue that somebody can complain now about the general verdict form. In a business that never gets started, if you're really going to award expectancy and profits, well, profits is a formula. It deals with gross revenues. You take from the gross revenues the costs of doing business, and you're left with profits. Here, the way this case was presented to the jury, the component parts that have to be recovered before you get to lost profits is what was argued to the jury. And to come after the fact and take the position that a general verdict form that you agreed to and jury instructions that you agreed to, including instructions 27 and 28, which are at 001352 and 001353 of the appendix, to somehow say that when you're dealing with expectancy and lost profits in a business that never got started, you're not entitled to recover what it cost you to get started in business in addition to your profits is nonsensical, and it doesn't match any kind of sound accounting basis that I've ever heard of in terms of doing business. You have to recover your cost to make a profit. Those of us who have been in the private practice of law, I think, understand that. Okay? So I just don't see the damages issue, given the stipulation to the exhibits, no objection during summation, and a stipulation to all of the jury instructions as being one that can be legitimately raised post-trial as it was. I tried the case. This case was flawless until Judge Lohrer said, when the jury went back to deliberate, that she granted the Rule 50 with respect to the abuse of process claim. I want to address that now. It is not inconsistent. I could have the best, most valid lawsuit in the world, and if I file it for an improper motive, that's what gives rise to the tort of abuse of process. It has nothing to do with the merits of the claim.
Mr. Gentile, yeah. Why didn't she change the verdict form, you know, if that was her ruling on that?
I asked her to. I demanded it. When she refused to do it, I moved for a mistrial. And David Rivers wanted her to send it back as it was.
Why?
What do I know? I don't know. I objected to it. I told her she shouldn't do it. But he asked her to do it, and it's in the record. You'll find it in the record. I think I have it here.
Okay. Well, I'm sure.
I have it. I could point you to it if it's in our brief. 001372 okay. Of the appendix.
My other question is, once the jury came back and we have the verdict form here and completed it, was there any discussion to send them back and re-deliberate to clarify their verdict? Or
that's exactly what happened. I objected to it. I said, Judge, you granted a Rule 50. You said when you granted it that if it came back, you were going to strike it. Okay? She found that there wasn't enough evidence to go to the jury on it. It was late in the day, and she said, oh, if it comes back, I'll strike it. That's in the record, and it's cited in the brief. Then, when it came back, I objected to her sending it back. I said, you said you were going to strike it, strike it. Mr. Rivers asked her to send it back. Now, she sent it back, I think, because she was a little bit reacting to a case that had just been decided. I think that in terms of the way she sent it back, even though it was over my objection, I think she probably complied with 49B, 49. I think she complied with it. So, I mean, I don't see any objection that they can have to that either. They asked for it. They got it. The jury came back. Jury had an opportunity to change their awards. They didn't. And on the record, they said, if it's not applicable, you know, then that's what the damages were awarded for, not for anything else. And so we just took them out. So, you know, I just don't see how a new trial can be had.
I just, in the verdict form, I've never seen, I see the amount they have here, $105,000 with the brackets and the, I don't think I've ever seen that in my whole legal career.
I've never seen one either. I got to think that collectively none of us has seen it.
Okay.
Now, let me address something that's a weakness in my case. I want to do that because I try to always stand in front of you and be honest. Bill Shack talked about $100,000 in attorney's fees. This is a general verdict form. The jury was instructed that they were not, when they sent the question out, which I don't know why the question is not in the record, but the transcript relates to it. When they sent the question out, judge instructed them, you are not to consider attorney's fees. There's a presumption that they followed the instructions, okay? Well, what do we know? We know that on the abuse of process claim, which they should have never had in the first place, they did indicate that they considered attorney's fees at least as to that claim. I must tell you that I would have a very hard time standing before you and saying that they followed the instruction because of that. Now, I don't know if it actually rebuts the presumption. I don't know that. But I cannot stand before you and make a good faith statement to you that with the general verdict form, wherein even though they were instructed that they weren't to consider attorney's fees, when they come back and they sign off on that form and they say that they did, it seems to me that they didn't follow the instruction with respect to that. And so while I might have to take a hit here because of it being a verdict form, I'm not going to stand up before you and pretend. I mean, it's possible it might have happened. And if that's what's got to happen, then that's
well, they said attorney's fees in the brackets, and they say $100,000 earnest money, and 5,000.
Right. No, I understand that. Now, clearly, that earnest money shouldn't have gone at all. The abuse of process claim should not have been submitted to the jury. She should have called it back. You know, woulda, shoulda, coulda. Hindsight's 20/20. But where we are today is where we are today. So I submit to you that there's no grounds here. One more thing. I think NRS 1810 absolutely permits, under the circumstances of this case, where you have a contract that called for attorney's fees to the prevailing party, the judge to say, okay, I'm going to take $100,000 off of your $158,000, but I'm going to give you the rest of it. Now, I want to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's about 5 minutes and 25
right.
seconds.
Thank you. Mr. Jimerson?
May it please the court. I couldn't respectfully disagree more with opposing counsel. You have in this argument an admission, a confession, that there's misconduct on the part of the jury in not following the jury instructions regarding the issue of attorney's fees. But that was at the request of the appellant slash respondent. Mr. Gentile wanted to try the issue of attorney's fees before the jury. Typically, as you know, it's submitted post-trial on the statements. You challenge that and you have an award if you have a prevailing party provision in the lease. Not the case. He insisted that the be damages to testify to a trial. Mr. Shack said $100,000. And of course, the jury must have considered that because they considered awarding respondents, my client, Ms. Austin, as president of court, age 75 today, she would receive $5,000 because they had imposed a Liz Pendens and a lien that they'd failed to protect against under the lease. They were supposed to prevent that, and it would cost $5,000 in fees to remove that Liz Pendens. So clearly we are guessing as to how the jury got to these damages. Let me begin by saying first, the court granted summary judgment that the contract, the lease option, had not been complied with for the failure at the outset to post $100,000 to buy the contract. The agreement, if you read it, starts at appellate number 66 through 87, talks in terms of $100,000 to buy the right to lease the building for 3 years and to have the option to purchase for $700,000 and a security deposit, another $100,000 later on. Never posted. So what did the trial court find? The trial court found that there had been a failure to buy that right. By virtue of that, there never was an option. By virtue of that, there can never be a claim for specific performance, and summary judgment is granted. So before the trial court even begins, we have the law of the case. It is completely ignored at trial. When you read the transcripts, the summation by Mr. Gentile is to ask for 7 years of damages, $2 million, for a breach of a 3-year lease on a project that hadn't even been built. They didn't even complete the project in the 3 years. And also, when you look at the verdict form, which you see is clearly inconsistent, the verdict form talks about breach of contract, which is expectancy damages, $265,000. Mr. Gentile asked for $367,000 at summation. Mr. Shack asked for $367,000. The jury gave $265,000. And the same claim, because if you look at the jury instructions, the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing said in the jury instruction, in contract. Contract damages.
So it wasn't in tort?
No, not at all. And that's where you have an inexplicable verdict. And Mr. Gentile, you know, sheepishly comes before you this afternoon or this morning to tell you he knows he's insecure on that point. There's no way to understand how they arrive at $885,600 in damages when you have expectancy of $265,000, $100,000 less than they asked for, and $620,000 comes nowhere. In post-trial motions, what was compelling is that there's a guess. There's a guess by both sides on how the jury gets there. But let me read to you what Mr. Gentile said to the court was the composition of $885,000. And he forgot the $600. It was $865,000. $248,400 for rent that they paid under the lease. $100,000 security deposit that wasn't returned. $170,000 in construction costs. And $367,200 in lost profits. For a total of $885,000, the verdict was $885,600. Here's the point, and this is where Mr. Gentile also tips his hand of weakness in why there's been reversible error committed by the trial court and by all parties. I'll comment about that further. In an expectancy breach of contract case, it is fundamental that you're entitled to your lost profits, and we can get into the minute point of gross profits versus net profits. But you're not entitled to the rent you paid under the lease. That's the cost of doing business. That's the cost of sale, in using the accounting terms. You're not entitled to $170,000 of construction costs. You undertook that cost in order to open up your daycare center so then you could start a business for breach of contract. When Mr. Gentile says today to you that you're entitled to recover the cost you invested, that's not true at all. That's not the definition of expectancy damages. That's not the definition of compensatory damages in the jury instructions that was submitted to the jury. So there's a complete failure on the jury to follow the jury instructions. But more than that, there is a confusing situation, reversible error by virtue of the jury wanting to award damages on both sides. It's almost as if the jury was saying, tell me what you want on your case, and tell me what on your case, and we'll try to give you both, try to satisfy you both. Mr. Gentile does acknowledge that on the day before the case was submitted for trial, he asked for a mistrial. Let me explain to you what happened on that point. This is what the judge said. Jury comes back, and they come back with this verdict, and the verdict is clearly inconsistent. Mr. Gentile knows that you, three of you, out of the seven of you, in 2008, June 12th, issued a slip opinion called Laird McGovern Bovis versus Book. The three of you were the seven members who voted. And at that time, you reversed Judge Lohr because she failed to comply with Rule 49B. You softened the take of Eberhard, which had been the blanket rule that if you didn't object, you waived it. But you got back to reading 49B, which says that the court shall not enter judgment in the event of an inconsistent verdict. You must send it back and ask the jury to reexamine their view and point out the inconsistency. And that didn't happen in Bovis and Bullock, and so the court reversed. And then you withdrew that opinion on June 12th and issued your final opinion on October 6th of 2008. So Judge Lohr, in July, in June 27th and 26th, when we were doing the Rule 50 motions and the Rule 59 motions later on, knew of your ruling. So she's maybe rebuffed by that. She's concerned about that. She makes a point of discussing that. But instead, she issues a directed verdict. The transcript that we pointed to you and cited to multiple times in our brief states, ladies and gentlemen, this is the instruction of the jury. After they act with the verdict, is clearly inconsistent. Ladies and gentlemen, yesterday after the case was submitted to you, the attorney did some legal things, and one of the things that the attorneys did at the end of the case was move that a certain one of the causes be dismissed. And I think I dismissed the abusive process claim that was filed by Mrs. Lawson against Shaq Parker. Not true. She didn't dismiss it. After she had ruled under Rule 50, after the jury had the case, then, post those events, then she said in the record, I'm inclined to grant the motion to strike on the abusive process. But she had already submitted the claim to the jury. Moore's federal practice is very clear. That's not the same as dismissing the case. It may have been her intent. You are right on as to why don't you take the time to revise the verdict? Why don't you take the time to revise your jury instructions? Why do you allow the jury to go forward? And you know what? Maybe she was just hoping the jury would bail her out and check no on abusive process claim. I submit to the court that there are genuine issues of material fact to support a verdict for abusive process, and my best evidence is they awarded $100,000 and 5,000 attorney's fees for an abusive process. So when you get to the fundamental issue of did she grant under Rule 50 a determination that no reasonable juror could find for abusive process, she was clearly in error in making that ruling because the jury so found within about 15 minutes after she submitted the case. Then, and when she decided to allow this to go to the jury, what did Mr. Gentile do? Mr. Gentile says, I move for a mistrial again. So understand, she never dismissed that claim. It is wrong for her to tell the jury that she had dismissed the claim. It is wrong for opposing counsel to claim she dismissed the claim because she submitted the claim to the jury, hoping that she could clarify it later on. And you know what Mr. Gentile said? He's concerned the case is going the other way. We don't know the result because it was so confusing because the damages and the looseness of the trial was not a credit to anyone and certainly not a credit to a judicial precedent. Mr. Gentile says at page 6 of the transcript of July 26th return to the jury, Your Honor, what you're doing, this is outside the presence of the jury, what you're doing is basically you're saying you're using a chancellor's foot approach to a matter of law. The jury has come back. They've come back with an appropriate number of jurors. And you are directing a verdict. He was right. And he asked for a mistrial. He was right. What she said to the jury was, continuing, and I dismissed the appeal. So I'm going to ask you to take the jury verdict back, and I'm going to ask you to discuss among yourselves what effect, if any, that had on your verdict. And after you have discussed among yourselves what effect, if any, my dismissal of this claim, which is not exactly what happened, then you can return this room. And within 5 minutes, the jury returned saying the $105,000 was stricken, N.A., not applicable. When you issued the Lehrer case, you know, the purpose that you have is broader than what I have. The purpose of justices of the Supreme Court is to send messages not only to lawyers, but in this case to judges of the trial court, of which all three of you are outstanding, in addition to being outstanding private practitioners, to let them know how a proper way to conduct a trial is. You told her that you had to send it back with instructions on how to proceed. The instructions was not, you are to take this as a dismissed case and what effect is on your verdict. The dismissal is, can you understand that the jury verdict form, excuse me, the jury instructions talk about abusive process. It talks about ulterior motive. It talks about for an improper purpose. It talks about causation. It talks about damages. You have found that in favor of Mrs. Lawson, $100,000 and 5,000 attorney's fees. But you've also found a breach of contract by the defendant in favor of the plaintiff. What impact does it have that you find that the lawsuit filed by this party, Schaff, was improperly filed? That I find inconsistent, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. Discussing with the lawyers, we ask you, which way do you come down on this? Would you please help us out? That's what you meant by Lehrer, by Governor Bovis, not to enter a directed verdict post-submission, post-return of the jury with a verdict that's inconsistent. And that's why Judge Lohr said on November 13th, at transcript 2126, matters off calendar and everybody that's going to appeal this thing, well, that's it. I've messed this case up as much as humanly possible, and it can go through the Supreme Court. This is a judge who left the bench on December 31 of 2008. Had she been reelected or chosen not to retire, she would have granted a motion for a new trial. My clients lost $1 million because of this, and she has the best of the case if it's retried. I ask you to do that,
please. You're asking for a complete reversal?
I am, yes, because the damages are so speculative and plain error. You can't possibly give somebody back the rent that they paid when they're rent, under a rent term, and they never comply with the fundamental term. Let me read one other thing, if I could. This is Mr. Gentile's co-counsel at the Rule 50 arguments. She says, well, with regard to the breach of contract, the option is just that. It's optional. There's no breach if you don't pay an option, and they never pay the option. And this is Ms. Hanks, Mr. Gentile's partner. So I'm not really sure how we still have a breach of contract claim. She's questioning her own claim going to the jury because the judge had already entered summary judgment saying that the $100,000 had never been paid for the right to have this contract. And to allow them to go beyond a term of 3 years for a lease term, to have 7 years of damages, $1,400,000 in lost profits, and all these other damages that total $2.1 million, which Mr. Gentile acknowledges is a complete weakness of this case, is how you get this judge five times in her brief, in her statements at different points, which you quote in a brief to demonstrate this case is a mess. That's the word she used.
Did the judge ever revise her summary judgment under Rule 54 at any time?
Never. It was the law of the case, the final submission of the jury, and the whole case was tried. And what happened to the credit opposing counsel, he keeps pounding on option, option, option. And here's the other point. The $100,000 for the option, Mr. Schaff put it up during trial or just before trial, 2 years after it was due. And it was a shock to everyone when we learned at trial, I wasn't there at the trial counsel, but Mr. Rivers, who was trial counsel, learned that the $100,000 even existed. And so when they moved for the $100,000, in their appeal, they asked you for the $100,000 back. Talk about inconsistent position. Judge Lohr says, wait a minute, your client took the witness stand and said it was for Mrs. Lawson to have the money. Now you're asking for the money back? And that's what you talked about, estoppel under oath. So this, when Mr. Gentile used the word, this is a minor point, I don't think the credibility of the witnesses is a minor point, and it demonstrates the absolute messed up nature, to use the words of the judge repeatedly. And beyond that, when you look at it as a reviewing court, we're talking about a 3 or 4 day trial. Not talking about a 3 week trial, not talking about some great need to everybody, but you're talking about somebody who's lost money for an inexplicable verdict that was clearly inconsistent. You can't wash it away in the rug and say it's not inconsistent. Of course it is. And instead of saying, how do you resolve that? Because that's what your teaching was for all the judges under Lehrer, she directs verdict. She uses the words of Mr. Gentile, a chancellor's boot. And I love this judge. I've tried many cases in front of her. This was not her best day, and this case is no credit to the bench.
You have some time left. We'll reserve your time. Mr. Gentile, you have 5 minutes and 21 seconds.
Mr. Gentile, could you address the overlapping damages issue in the 265 and the 620, okay. How they're broken out, and was it the implied covenant award, was that for contract or tort?
And before you conclude your remarks, I would like to know what disposition you are seeking here, and as much as Mr. Jimerson is seeking a complete reversal for a new trial, what would your requested disposition be?
My request would be to either affirm or to remit, one or the other. And I think that that's doable, and I actually have prepared that as a backup position. First of all, let me say something. If you have a going business, and there's a breach of a contract, and it doesn't, even if it puts an end to your business, okay, at least you had an opportunity to recover your costs. When you're dealing with something like this, which is really kind of unique, maybe it's not unique, but it's certainly not the ordinary situation. There was never an opportunity. First of all, they had to keep paying the rent in order to basically stand on their rights. They had to do that. All right, they had to pay the $100,000 security deposit. They had to do that. They had to pay personnel to be able to get the place in shape.
Well, the $100,000, was it an option payment or a security deposit?
There were two.
See, that's the point.
Okay, I'm sorry. Clarify that.
All right. So all of those things had to be paid in order to get open, and you don't make profit until you recover that. And so on the facts of this case, because of the total frustration of the purpose of the lessee by the lessor, they should be entitled to recover the money that they had to pay to have the hope of doing business and obtaining a profit. There was also testimony as to what the profit should be. So I really believe that on the facts of this case, you have to take into consideration the recapture of the front money costs before you can get to the profit stage, and then you add to that the profits, okay? I am saying that with a straight face. I'm not backing off of that. There's simply no way that you can do justice in a case like this unless you allow that. It's different if a business is ongoing and there's a breach of contract. Then you're going to have those costs anyhow, and you have your expectancy in terms of what your profit would be. So you recaptured the cost from the rest of the business that you were doing and have this expectancy of profit. I've been in business a long time. I have a little bit of understanding about that. In terms of a fallback position on that, I think there's two ways you could do it. I don't like the idea of expectancy because I don't think it's fair, okay? But if you were going to do expectancy, you'd have to take what the profits would be, and you have two ways to do that. You could do it on a three-year basis. You could do it on a year-and-a-half basis if you feel that there would have never been a renewal of this lease, okay? But that was never argued at the by Mrs. Lawson's lawyer at the trial. Or you could take it on what the true expectancy was, which is that maybe it would go the whole 7 years if they'd have been able to buy it or extend the lease.
Aren't you asking us really to retry this case here in the appellate court?
No, I'm not. I don't want you to do that. But you ask for if you're thinking in terms of a remitter, I think what you have to do is you have to have that kind of an analysis here. Okay, so there's got to be a component for profit.
We've been preaching to the district court judges, and of course all three of us were, and made the same type of mistakes that some of the judges make. If you make a mistake, please correct it before it gets to us. And we encourage that with the judges. And I wish she...
Well, she had every opportunity to not make the mistake.
I know.
Okay? And frankly, the mistake should be borne. You know, there's a difference. Lehrer was a situation where you clarified the question of if you don't ask for it, you get it anyhow. All right? There's not a waiver. They asked for it here. Okay? That's so different than Lehrer. Mr. Rivers asked for the judge to do exactly what she did.
Well, Laird, I believe the parties didn't ask for a special verdict or special interrogatories, and she gave them anyway.
In this instance, he did ask for it, mm-hmm. Justice Gibbons.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, you can't get two bites of the apple. Mm-hmm. All right? I mean, that's really unfair to the adverse party. You know, if he didn't ask for it, you respond to it differently. Maybe I would have responded to it differently. But he did ask for it. Now, you can't ask for it and then complain about it later. You can't do both.
Mr. Jatoki, briefly tell me about these damages. I'm really kind of fixated on this, on these the implied covenant. First of all, were they contract or tort? And where's
no contract damages?
They were or were not.
They are contract.
Okay. Now, where did the 620 come from in relation to the 265?
The only thing that I could figure is that would have been assessed for the front money costs, because the 265 comes real close to the profit. I mean, it's a general verdict form, okay? But when you start adding up the front money costs, you got $100,000 security deposit, you got $248,000 in rent, you got $100,000 escrow. Well, that shouldn't come back. You got $100,000 attorney's fees. If you're going to talk about attorney's fees, then that's where it is, if it's included. You have $168,000 in construction costs, all right, and $260,000 in operational salaries. I mean, that actually totals up to $976,000 without the $58,000 additional money for the attorney's fees that exceeded the $100,000. So, I mean, I see that's where it is. That's okay. My take on it.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
And thank you for...
Thank you, Mr.
Well,
Van
I got
Kill.
16 seconds, 17.
No, no, that's over. That's your overtime.
Far be it for me not to charge by the second.
He's done that before, Your Honor.
Mr. Jimerson, go ahead with your rebuttal now.
The appellant had a remedy, and he had an election. He could seek rescission, which he did not seek. He sought breach of contract. As he said, the parties stipulated to the jury instructions. The jury instructions do not allow an award of the cost of getting into business. You're absolutely right, Justice Gibbons. They do not allow for the cost of construction or the rent you pay. They even claimed a testimony at trial that they were entitled to the salary that Mr. Shack's daughter received of $250,000, if you can believe it, never having been paid that much at any other time. They even asked for the cost of a loan that they made. I'm sorry, you take a loan for $260,000, there's no damage. But they even asked for that for damages. That's how this case got run out of way. That's why Judge Lohr was convinced privately and publicly on the record that this is a mess. The jury instructions were stipulated to. They don't call for these kind of damages. You're not entitled to the things that he's now asking for, the cost of getting a new business. Yes, it was a new business. That's why loss of profit damages are generally speculative, because you have no track record. So now I do need to correct opposing counsel respectfully. Mr. Rivers read Lair. He read your comments. He asked the judge to make an inquiry of the jury as to how they can resolve this inconsistent verdict. When you look at the jury instruction on abusive process, it's clear they found misconduct on the part of William Shack. But she didn't do that. So what he asked for was something she refused to do. She simply gave a directed verdict to the jury saying, I've dismissed the case, which, by the way, was not an accurate reflection of the proceedings as they actually occurred. So I understand that Mr. Rivers asked the court to do the right thing. The court misinterpreted your case, didn't follow Rule 49B, and didn't ask the jury to return to deliberations with regard to that. She simply said, I've entered a dismissal. Now, what effect does that have on us? Well, they were just told, subtract $105,000. And then at the end, in the Rule 59 motions on November 13th, she gives it back because she holds him to the fact that he on the way to stand that said that they should have the money. I don't know. Your Honor is right, Justice Sherry. Justice Saida, I don't know how you try this case on appeal and enter a verdict. It's inexplicable, and that's why it must be reversed. And my client would be severely prejudiced, and injustice would occur unless that's the proper remedy. And we thank you all three for your time. My client does the same.
Well, the panel
I also wanted the record reflect that Mario Lovato, who was an accountant, was an associate in our firm and now started his own firm as co-counsel, and we welcome her to the Supreme Court.
Welcome to the Supreme Court.
Thank you all so much.
Thanks to both lawyers in this matter for the spirited argument, the briefs in this matter.
Thank you.
We appreciate your professionalism, both of you.